Hello, welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, I speak to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. And check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. If you're listening to this podcast on its release, then you'll only have about 1 week left to support it by taking advantage of a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. That offer will be coming to an end at the end of this year, but in it you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five great books published by Hearst. Check out the offer via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Purchasing through it is cheaper than Amazon, and it helps support this podcast. Titles included on the list are written by authors who have featured on previous episodes of Turkey Book Talk. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poison Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. To order any of those titles, visit hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com, where all the books are listed with a third knocked off their original price. But remember, make sure you do it before the end of 2017. Alternatively, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, consider supporting it through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. The standard pledge is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want. And you can check out details and links to that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now I'll crack on with this latest episode. In it, I speak to Ezgi Başaran. She's a journalist, the former editor-in-chief of the much-missed newspaper Radikal. She's currently based at Oxford University's St. Anthony's College, where she's a coordinator on its programme on contemporary Turkey, after spending over 10 years in the Turkish media. Ezgi is the author of the recently released book Frontline Turkey, The Conflict at the Heart of the Middle East, published by IB Taurus. The book is a breezy 200-page account of contemporary Turkey's political situation, specifically focusing on the peace process between the state and the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, which was running for over 2 years before collapsing in summer 2015. Since that collapse, Turkey has accelerated down the authoritarian path. Thousands of people have been killed, hundreds of thousands have been displaced, neighbourhoods in the southeast have been razed to the ground, and many Kurdish issue-focused politicians have been locked up, including Selahattin Demirtas, the co-chair of the People's Democratic Party, HDP. Frontline Turkey is a forensic account of the run-up to the peace process, what happened during it, and how it collapsed. The book also focuses on the misdeeds of the Gulen movement, sometimes overlooked these days in English language accounts, but crucial to recognise to understand how Turkey got in the bad state it is in today. We address all that later in the conversation, but I started by asking Ezgi Başaran to talk about what she was hoping to achieve when she set out to write the book.
The main aim of writing this book for me was to tell the truth about a period which was so crucial for Turkey. This book is more about setting the record straight on how Turkey's deepest conflict has gotten deeper at a time when there emerged a solution, and how the collapse of peace talks with its Kurds brought Turkey's democratic institutions into a collapse. But I also would like, I wanted to offer an alternative way to look at the Middle East for the non-Turkish audience. Because for me, my argument is the solution to what is happening in the Middle East is directly related to Turkey's 40-year-old Kurdish problem and how the Turkish government chose to deal with it.
Yeah, I was thinking throughout as I was reading this, as I was reading the book, you know, today there's obviously this kind of ultra-nationalism that's right really at the centre of the government, and apparently it's getting more strident by the day really. I don't know, it was almost surreal as I was reading to kind of recall that not so very long ago there was this kind of peace deal that seemed to be very hopeful between the Turkish state and the PKK. You know, a kind of solution did seem in sight. It seems almost surreal to read that now, bearing in mind the kind of atmosphere that we have.
That's exactly was my point in writing this book. The book covers a period of many firsts for modern Turkey. And the events mentioned in the book, you know, when I gave seminars on the book here in the UK, when I list those firsts to the audience, they sound really outrageous to them. But they happened only in 2 years, between 2013 and 2016, starting with the peace process, ending with a coup attempt. And so we do tend to forget that, what we went through, good or bad. I mean, the book proves its point when you feel surreal, because 3 years ago, Abdullah Öcalan was sitting across the National Intelligence Agency chief at a table and talking about Syria, you know, how Syria is a red line for themselves, and the not Hakan Fidan, but another authority from the National Intelligence Agency was, you know, saying that also Syria is another red line for Tayyip Erdogan. So Syria being a red line is not a surprise, but having MIT on the one side and Abdullah Öcalan on the other does come as something surreal at a time when even the HDP leader Selahattin Demirtas is jailed for almost a year now. So yeah, I do understand how you feel, William.
And it's good that you mentioned Syria there, because I wonder if we could just kind of go back really to the start of the peace process, because It's often forgotten now, but one of the reasons why the Turkish government wanted, or it was felt like it was almost pushed towards trying to come to some kind of peace agreement, was because of what was going on in Syria. And it wanted to kind of nip in the bud, really, the kind of Kurdish advances in northern Syria. And it thought that the best way at the time to do that was to initiate this peace process. I wonder if you could just kind of talk us through a bit what the forces were pushing both sides really to come to the table.
So the book, in the book, I track the sequence of events from the emergence of the AKP to that of the Turkish-Kurdish peace process. So the story of Erdogan's deeds in the context of the peace process, I argue, serve to demonstrate how a populist strongman do instrumentalize people's hopes to maximize his own individual power. So the consequences of the collapse of this peace process is very, very related, like you said, to the Syrian war. And for some, it sounds really not relevant, but let me tell you how. When the war in Syria first erupted, Turkey's leadership was adamant that it would be only a matter of months before Bashar al-Assad was ousted. This obviously did not happen, and Turkey's Syrian policy has proven to be an epic failure, which has brought Turkey into conflict with its Western allies and stifled the global fight against ISIS. And Turkey unfortunately built this explosive triangle after the collapse of the peace process. You know, one angle there is the Kurds, and on the top there is the Turks, and on the right there is the ISIS. So when it became apparent that Assad was not going anywhere anytime soon, Turkey's main objective in Syria shifted to obstructing PYD, the Syrian Kurds, in their bid to form an autonomous region in the north of Syria, in Rojava. So because of that, from the end of 2013 to the start of 2015, Turkey saw no problem in having an open border policy for the jihadists in Syria. And as a result, this turned the country into a hub for jihadists, including ISIS recruits. And this has caused huge security vulnerabilities for Europe too, and also Turkey. So here's the question for me. Why would Turkey prefer jihadists as neighbors on the Syrian border? And this is a question that I get all the time from seminars. Why would Turkey prefer jihadists as neighbors on the Syrian border rather than Kurds? And my answer is for the very simple reason that the PYD was ideologically affiliated with the PKK, and that an autonomous Kurdish region in Syria would be of an example for the Kurds in Turkey. So to summarize, we can say, like you said, Turkey's peace process with the Kurds collapsed mainly owing to the expansion of the Syrian Kurdish cantons next to Turkish border, and also, like I underline in the book, also because of President Tayyip Erdogan's ambitions to create an executive presidency for himself.
And that really came into focus really in 2015, of course. In retrospect, it all seems kind of quite logical what happened. You know, there was the June 2015 election, the peace process was ongoing until then. The AKP ended up losing almost 10 percentage points of its support.
Yeah, the mandate.
And it couldn't form a majority in parliament. Soon after that, the peace process collapsed.
Exactly.
There was a really harsh crackdown. And then when the snap election was held in November of the same year, the AKP kind of was able to rally a kind of nationalist support base and ended up returning to government. And that kind of set the course to what we've had now. So I don't know, it seems in retrospect that the calculation that they made was the electoral calculation, the political calculation that that Erdogan and the AKP made was almost justified.
Exactly. I was really diligent, you know, to portray those events that starts from February 2015 to the 20th of July when the peace process collapsed. And in February, actually, there was this Dolmabahçe, you know, meeting, which was a turning point for the peace process. But it turned out that it was not the case that the peace process was not, you know, going in the right direction that we thought it was. And the events that I list and the rhetoric that had governed the AKP and also President Erdogan prove that President Erdogan thought the peace process was not helping the AKP, on the contrary, helping HDP gain more votes, political party of the Kurdish movement in Turkey. If we look back at those days, day by day, week by week, you know, announcement by announcement, we see that it was also AKP's leadership that decided all of a sudden that there's no point in pursuing this peace process. Because, like you said, now the Syrian war wasn't helping them, was not going into a place where they imagined that it would go. And also, they were not gaining any votes because they're in a peace process. But the peace process was helping the HDP, which actually, by crushing the 10% threshold in the election, toppled AKP's years-long, decades-long first-party rule, one-party rule, I'm sorry.
And they kind of learned the lesson. It's funny, like, at the time, it was kind of confusing what was going on, but it's clear that the AKP was kind of pincered, really. It lost a lot of Turkish nationalist support in June 2015, and it also lost a lot of the previous Kurdish support that it had, which went to the HDP, so that was really what caused it to kind of collapse in the vote in the June 2015 election.
Exactly. But, I mean, following 7th of June elections, AKP made a new calculation as to how it's going to deal with the Kurdish conflict from then on. But also the PKK had miscalculated too. I mean, it thought that the HDP's victory on the 7th of June could be interpreted as support for the PKK. On the contrary, its unprecedented success at the Balobax meant support for the peace process, for ceasefire, not for the PKK. So the PKK anticipated that the legitimacy and the backing it received in Syria for fighting ISIS would continue for the urban warfare they had started in Turkey after the peace process collapsed. And the PKK leaders were wrong. This miscalculation led to this urban warfare and caused hundreds of lives and hundreds of thousands of relocations in the region. And this is why now Kurds in Turkey are so tired, so exhausted, and feel so detached and betrayed by both sides, by the state and by the PKK. They wanted peace, really. They didn't want the war to come in their shopping malls, in their streets, in the form of trenches, and they are really exhausted, and that's why they keep silent, despite that all of their mayorships are confiscated by the state. Their party's co-chairs are in jail for more than a year. You know, it's very understandable.
Going back to the peace process itself, as you describe it in the book, and as it was clear at the time, actually, as it was going on, a lot of people commented on this, but you portray the process really as this kind of closed shop. Nobody really knew what was going on or what was being negotiated. And it was basically being overseen on the one side by president or prime minister at the time, for some of that time, Erdogan, and Abdul Öcalan, in jail since 1999 on the PKK side. And really, it was these two men who were kind of steering both sides. And obviously, because there were these two men who were basically directing these two sides, I wondered if Öcalan, he obviously has this huge influence over the PKK and the fighters, not just in Turkey, not just the young fighters in various towns, but, you know, the PKK fighters in the mountains. Really, his word is law. And whatever kind of agreement he came to, if he gave his seal of approval, you know, would have been able to convince the PKK rank and file. I just wonder if that was a real missed opportunity there. You kind of had him clearly wanting to make some kind of agreement, and it kind of slipped through the grasp.
Yes, not only because the government had a willing Öcalan on the table, but more so because there's this one generation, the generation of Öcalan, the generation of Şerafettin Elçi, and you know, older, you know, elderly in the Kurdish movement who had very close relationship with the state and with the politicians, and they had relationships prior to 1990s, so they had seen more than what the Kurdish youth who were born in Diyarbakir, in Şırnak, in Hakkari in 1990s into a war zone. So this is a lost opportunity, because now with the example of Rojava and with the collapse of this peace process in back of their mind, it would be really hard to satisfy and mitigate these youth's anger and detachment from the Turkish state. But the second point I would like to make to your question is actually the framework of this whole peace process was built in a wrong way. I mean, as far as peace negotiation, you know, literature and IR literature goes, the bargaining theory should not be followed as it did in the Turkey's Kurdish peace process. You can't not have, you know, people who hold the gun in their hands on the table. You can't, you know, sideline them and have a man in a jail under heavy surveillance of the government proceed with everything and have the legitimate political party degraded into a postman status. So, I mean, there's a lot of mishaps done in the framework. And there are several scholars who are looking into this in this theoretical peace negotiation framework. And yes, having a willing Öcalan was really important, but making him as the sole negotiator was a terrible mistake. That's what I think.
And there was a real disconnect as well that became clear during the peace process between Öcalan and the PKK commanders in Kandil. And there was also a kind of thing that became clear after the peace process broke down, but there had been this kind of weapon stockpiling, really, among young urban Kurds in various towns. And once the peace process collapsed, they were ready to fight, and they were more than happy to kind of engage once the government had decided to throw in the towel. I just wonder if you could kind of talk a bit about that aspect as well, you know, about the being it takes two to tango, really, and particularly, you know, how did they stockpile these weapons during the peace process? Because it seems like a real paradox, you know, you're running this peace process and then at the same time you're getting ready for when it all inevitably comes crashing down.
Yeah, the thing was, I mean, in 2013, when I had interviewed the PKK leader at the time, he told me that we are in a peace process and the government is building dams around the border. And we think that the government will deceive us, thinks that it's going to deceive us with the peace process and, you know, is going to build these dams so that the PKK members could not cross. And he also said that we already have, you know, PKK members in Turkey, so this is not a logical, pragmatic move. So they were thinking that there was this huge trust issue between the Turkish government and the Kurdish movement at the start of the peace process. And the things that happened during that process, the killings of three PKK members in Paris, and you know, leaking of the Oslo tapes before that, really exacerbated the mistrust between these two parties. And unfortunately, because there were not any legal framework, because the parliament wasn't also included, the Kurdish movement thought that the government is buying time for the war, while the Turkish government was thinking that Kurds were also buying time for another intifada, if one might make this, you know, comparison. But in 2015, when the peace process collapsed, we now know that before the collapse, actually, 3 months before the collapse, Abdullah Öcalan was saying that it's hard to control the youth. And you know, he says that he doesn't want the youth branch, YDGH, to bring the war to the streets. And he was referring to the events of Kobani. So we have this leadership who thinks that the youth should stay in and you know, keep their anger and should let the older ones deal with the events. But I don't really know the logistics of how the PKK had stocked those, you know, weapons. But I had the chance to ask the then HPG commander in chief after the collapse through a letter asking him how did this happen. I mean, and he said that they already had the weapons and they had not stockpiled any weapon during the peace process, if you believe that. I have no other special information other than these ones.
Well, if you ask the government, it was all part of a cooperation between the PKK and the Gulen movement, who, of course, you know, had people wanting to encourage them to stockpile weapons and then end up dividing Turkey.
Yes, I don't see any possibility that Kurdish movement would be in collaboration with the Gulen movement. And they have been in kind of a mental and material void before AKP, when AKP was in alliance with them. So I can't seem to buy this argument of the government having PKK and, you know, Fethullah Gulen movement being in collaboration to divide Turkey. They might have their own plans to divide Turkey, but I don't think they would collaborate in doing that.
It's really absurd to make that accusation, because I remember at the time as well, during the peace process, I remember Emre Uslu, who was writing columns, like going mad about how the PKK was stockpiling weapons, and he was saying, you know, this is terrible and we've got to do something about this to prevent this. And presumably he would have been, in that case, very happy when the peace process collapsed, if you follow that logic to its extent.
I totally agree. I totally agree with you. I think Gulen movement did everything in their power to derail this peace process in every way, I think, possible. You know, they lobbied against it. They actually, with an operation among their cells in the National Intelligence Agency, and in complicit with the death of three PKK members in Paris, and, you know, through their media people, like you said, Emre Uslu, and, you know, they weren't really happy with this peace process from the start. I mean, it's very obvious that they were the ones who leaked the Oslo records. It caused like 3 years of mistrust between the Kurdish movement and the National Intelligence Agency. And then the killings of three PKK members also caused a mistrust on the part of the Kurdish movement regarding government. And their idea of organization, I mean, the PKK and the Gulen movement, is very different. And this is why they were fighting each other since, you know, 1990s in the region.
And moving on really to this question about the Gulen movement, I mean, it's impossible really to address Turkey's recent history without examining the kind of rise and fall of the Gulen organization. And obviously throughout your career, you've witnessed how this group went from being a very close ally of the government to being declared now a terrorist organization. And you were always skeptical about them, actually, unlike many people in the government and in the media elsewhere. Could you just kind of talk us through a bit about the influence of this group over the years in Turkey, how it kind of developed and how it rose and how it fell?
Well, after the coup attempt, you know, all my colleagues in Western media outlets were really so surprised and could not really believe that an Islamic cleric living in Pennsylvania would be of any capability of orchestrating a coup. The reason was, while we and, you know, like you said, a small number of journalists were writing about the fabrication of evidences during the very important trials of Ergenekon and Sledgehammer Balyoz, they were happy praising both the government and the Gulen movement, because it served the Western governments as a great model of moderate Islam and pro-business, with a pro-business mindset. So, you know, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, to get to his ultimate destination, formed a tacit alliance with Fethullah Gulen. And Gulenists were followers of Sufi Islam, who had been investing in education to raise their so-called generation, on top of building a global empire of of Gulen schools, which amounts to, I think, according to Forbes, $25 to $50 billion. It's a quite big of a range, but because it's a very opaque movement, we don't really know the exact financial terms of this group. So it's between $25 to $50 billion. So the movement has also infiltrated the Turkish judiciary, bureaucracy, and police since the late 1980s. So initially, for the first decade of the AKP's rule, Gulen has formed the backbone of the bureaucracy, and they landed the AKP helping out in its struggle with the secular establishment. But from 2011 onwards, that means when Erdogan began to consolidate his position in the government, a power struggle erupted between his party and this Gulen movement. So former partners became bitter foes. And the 15th of July 2016 coup attempt was the final skirmish in this battle. It's really hard to formulate how this, you know, Sufi Islam movement composed of Gulenists can infiltrate into state. I mean, to national intelligence agency, to judiciary, and, you know, build huge, gigantic lobbying mechanisms in Europe, in the UK, in the United States. It's really hard to tell this to the Western world if they just started reading about Turkey with the coup attempt. I have read thousands of pages long, you know, indictments of Ergenekon and Balyoz, and also had done quite, you know, extensive research into this organism. And because of that, I was targeted by them. My name was on a list of journalists that was supposed to be in jail during the Ergenekon case. I was being, you know, tagged of a coup lover and army bootlicker and all sorts of things, because I was trying to make a point that this is a very, very dangerous organization who is fabricating evidence to even get half of the army in jail. And then it wasn't about the army. I mean, my writings weren't about the army, was not about the deep state, but it was to show that there's something really awkward going on. And I think Gulen movement constructs the horror of what a deep state stands for me. I mean, they are the most dangerous thing that happened to Turkish Republic since its founding. That's what I think.
And you mentioned that it's extremely frustrating to try and get foreign...
Exactly. It's getting harder and harder. It wasn't as hard as it was after the coup. But now, because, you know, AKP government, you know, does have a very authoritarian climate built in, you know, overarching in Turkey, you know, with hundreds of journalists in jail, for example, people like Osman Kavala and many of my colleagues, academics being, you know, indicted. It's really hard to maintain the narrative for the Western audiences that this, you know, Fethullah Gulen movement is really dangerous, because they see an authoritarian government, you know, locking up journalists. So they think that it brings this argument that the coup can be also fake for Erdogan to gain more power, and that Fethullah Gulen movement is just only a victim and of an authoritarian regime. I mean, because they see Turkish politics in binary terms, and if you don't get into detail, it does look like that. I mean, they see like there's this authoritarian regime, so Gulen movement must be innocent. Well, I mean, you can't look at a country, to politics, to international relations in binary terms. It's not zero or one. It's, you can have an authoritarian regime and also a very dangerous organization. That's what I try to tell. But I mean, Turkish government is not helping people living outside Turkey to make this argument, really.
Yeah, I don't know, I do think you've really hit the nail on the head there. Like, it's people just like simple binaries, you know. Erdogan's become so erratic and authoritarian and unpleasant, really. It's very hard to hold in your head the idea that some of those who now oppose him, in this case the Gulen movement, may also be very bad and have also committed many crimes and are also in many ways very responsible for bringing the situation in Turkey to its current sad state, really.
The problem is, you know, because no judicial process, we can't really know how many of the purges were, you know, logical, how many people being laid off have real, you know, ties with the Gulen movement, especially ties with the coup attempt. But the idea is, the idea that Turkish government being authoritarian vindicates a seriously dangerous organization is beyond belief for me, but Salavi for us at the moment.
Now, just kind of bringing up to the present, I mean, the current situation is pretty grim, really. There's a lot of pessimism around, I think, which you largely share. What do you make of the current situation in Turkey? I mean, there's this seemingly ever stronger coalition, really, of the right, and it looks fairly unshakable, really, to be honest. And a lot of people are very pessimistic about this. I mean, do you see any prospect at all of a kind of return, in a way, to a peace process of some kind, or some way that electoral calculation will push the AKP towards trying to make some kind of Kurdish opening in the future? It may be like ridiculously optimistic at this point, but you know, we know that things can shift very fast. So
To be perfectly honest, I believe that Tayyip Erdogan is a political wizard. I mean, he has the power and talent to spin anything in a matter of minutes. So if he won it, even though, you know, the rhetoric has gone pretty nationalistic, and there is this, you know, 70% block when it comes to Kurdish issue that consolidated itself, you know, the secular nationalists, you know, mainly CHP electorate, MHP electorate, and AKP electorate. When it comes to Kurdish issue, they form this huge 70% block against the Kurds. And I think this in part is strongly consolidated at the moment. But like I said, if someone like Tayyip Erdogan sincerely wanted to go back to a peace process, he would find a way. But I don't think he wants that, because he realized that it's not helping. You know, he uses all of these agencies, like he uses the EU accession process, a tool, you know, to gain approbation both within and outside the country. We should all remember that he said, you know, he once said, democracy is like a train. You get off once you reach your destination. So, you know, the Kurdish peace process, he thought, was another vehicle, but it turned out that it wasn't helping him as much as it did the Kurdish movement. So he sees the world in pragmatic terms. So I don't think he's going back to the Kurdish peace process anytime soon, before, you know, he makes sure that, you know, before the 2019 presidential elections. So until then, unfortunately, we are on a really, really bumpy road in a grim, hopeless weather where nobody's talking about the Kurdish peace process. The nationalistic rhetoric is unfortunately governing Turkey. And it's really sad that nobody is really thinking how Kurds are feeling, how Kurdish youth is feeling at the moment, because it is drifting them further apart every day. You know, disintegrating, dismembering does not always happen in territorial terms. What we're going through after the collapse of the peace process is a total detachment of the Kurds from Turkey in their heart and in their mind. And this really saddens me, because we did have a chance. Everything could be better. Turkey would be more powerful in the Middle East. The Middle East would have a viable truce plan with Kurds and Turks collaborating in Syria. And now everything is, you know, in the bin.
And just finally, it's a very pessimistic kind of prognosis we make there. But what about currently for yourself? I mean, you're now, I believe, at Oxford University, overseeing a Turkey-based program there. Do you see any prospect of yourself returning to Turkey to work in the near future or not?
Well, I mean, my contract, I have 2 more years of contract with the university. I'm also doing a Master of Philosophy in Modern Middle Eastern Studies, learning Arabic, which is really challenging. But, I mean, this is nothing like journalism. I mean, journalism is my identity, and I miss my job very, very much, to be perfectly honest. But I think it was time for me to take a break from the newsroom and, you know, to look at things at the Middle East. At the Kurdish issue to my country is really nice, because it's really helping understand things. But if, you know, after my MPhil finishes, after my contract finishes with the university, I would like to go back to my country and to my job, really, if there is any left.
If the contract's 2 years, you can be back in time for the presidential election in 2019. It's very exciting.
Oh, yes, William. What are you trying to... I would like to follow that event.
Back to the madhouse.
Yes, back to the madhouse. Well, that's what journalism is, actually. And, you know, looking at a broader picture to the world, I mean, there's this huge wave of right-wing populism in Greece, in Hungary, in Poland, in United States, in Britain, and also, obviously, in the Middle East. So I don't see a, you know, optimistic picture in 5 years, but I think in 10 years, the liberal international order would regain, and in that time, it's time for the liberals and, to make some self-criticisms of what went wrong with the world, really. So it's not about Turkey, it's about everywhere, and journalists everywhere are suffering, not only with the digital, digitalization and how the business, how our trade is threatened by the falling down ad revenues, but also we are being chastised from Trump to Erdogan everywhere in the world at the moment. So it's time for us journalists too to rise up, but I will do it in 2019, obviously, after my contract expires with the University of Oxford.
That was Eski Başaran, many thanks to her. Don't forget, you've only got until the end of 2017 to support the Turkey Book Talk podcast by taking advantage of a 33% discount plus free delivery by purchasing any one of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available, visit the special page created for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Another way to support the podcast is via my Patreon account, making a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. Many thanks to my current Patreon supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan Marcus Vommel, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, Max Hoffman, Andrew McDowell, Paul Levin, Tan Tunala, and Isla Jean Yackley. To help increase awareness of the podcast for other potential listeners, please do rate or review it on whatever platform you listen on, follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and email with any recommendations, feedback, or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. This is the last episode of 2017, so I just want to say a special thank you to everybody really who's listened over the course of the year. I think we've put together some very nice episodes that I hope you've found as useful and enjoyable as I have. I'm planning to make a few small changes next year to improve the podcast further and hopefully enhance and deepen the whole listening experience. It's all still in the planning stage at the moment, but I hope to share more details with you early in the new year. But until then, once again, thank you very much for listening.